org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning, and welcome to this January 28th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. It's my pleasure to welcome Christopher Noxon and Tara Eisen to the show this morning. For a sort of morning in Hollywood, Christopher is with me now, and Tara will join me for the second half of the show, so stay tuned for that. Christopher Noxon is an author, journalist, and illustrator. He's the author of the novel Plus One, which we'll be talking about this morning. Mad Men creator Matthew Weiner called well-observed, honest, and laugh-out-loud funny. He's also the author of Rejuvenile, Kickball, Cartoons, Cupcakes, and the Reinvention of the American Grown-Up, which Ira Glass, host of This American Life, called an eye-opener. The book was featured in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, the New York Times, CNN's In the Money, on and on. As a journalist, he has written for The New Yorker, Details, The New York Times Magazine, LA Times Magazine, and Salon. His illustrations have been featured in numerous websites, and along the way, he has worked as a costume character at Universal Studios, answered letters of complaint at L'Oreal Cosmetics, and was the director of communication for Michael Milton's prostate cancer charity. He lives in L.A. with his wife, television writer and producer Genji Cohen, and their three children. My huge pleasure to welcome him. Chris, hi.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. What a fun book. What a great book.
I appreciate that. That's quite a resume that you've read. Those are all my various and crazy jobs over the years.
And I could have gone on and on. I cut your resume quite a bit, so I love it. I love it. I'm sure the stint at Universal Studios did the most to prepare you for crazy for running a household
with
three kids.
Those were very sweaty years. Very sweaty years.
Right. All right. So I'm going to give, you know, I introduced you, but I'm going to give you a chance to sort of introduce yourself, really introduce the novel, talk about Plus One and how it came into the world and kind of take us into this guy's life.
Well, I had written this book, Rejuvenile, which is a very heavily reported kind of quasi-sociological nonfiction book about what it means to be a grown-up and how the definition of maturity has changed over the years. And at the time, my wife had just written the show Weeds, and it started to sort of take off. And the money that I was bringing in as a freelancer, I had been a journalist before that, sort of wasn't factoring in for our family anymore. It kind of felt more like a hobby than a profession.
I
really had to sort of ask myself what I wanted to do. We have three kids, and I sort of settled into the support role. And started, you know, making dinner and doing carpools and being a real caretaker at the house. And it was terrific. I was having a really terrific time and having amazingly special times with my children. But at the same time, I felt this sort of weird insecurity around being a male householder.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this kind of strange experience with, you know, just kind of sublimated aggression. I was peeling out in the minivan and, you know, mowing down kids at laser tag birthday parties and kind of dealing with this internal sludge that kept backing up on me and having a hard time when people would ask me what I did. You know, what do you do? I didn't have a really good answer. I couldn't call myself a house husband. That felt just awful. Yeah. I started calling myself a domestic first responder because that felt manlier to me.
Right.
So I started writing about it, and I didn't write for an audience. For the first time really in my life, I started writing without a gig. I didn't have an editor. I had written Rejuvenile and everything before that with as work. And I just knew that there was story here. And pretty soon, you know, I wrote an essay or two, thought about that, writing a book of essays about sort of life as a Hollywood house husband, but realized I didn't even want to read that book. I definitely didn't want to write it, partially just because my own story is actually not all that interesting. My life is fairly uneventful. But I wanted to write something a story, you know, something with a beginning, a middle, and an end, something really juicy. And I wanted to get into stuff that I hadn't experienced myself, but I knew other people were. It was my suspicion that a lot of guys in this position kind of blow up their lives and go off the rails. The track record for male householders is pretty dismal, actually, in my experience, or from people I know.
Is that right?
So I wanted to kind of tell a tragic and sort of cautionary, juicy story, and kind of have the midlife crisis that I might have on the page instead of in my life.
Yep, yep.
So I sort of spun out all the insecurities that I had and all the anxieties to the place where I felt like the most drama and the most story could be.
Right.
And it became fiction, and the character that I was writing about quickly didn't, you know, went well beyond anything I've ever experienced. The wife became someone new, the kids changed, and I had a kind of fictional world.
I was going to ask you, when you are writing, because sometimes I feel like when we're writing very close to who we are in the beginning, it's almost limiting. It's almost easier, writers tell me, to, you know, if they're a 30-year-old woman, to write about an 86-year-old man, to take themselves totally out of the equation. And I was wondering if you had any difficulties in rendering these characters, because they aren't you. But was it harder to write characters who began looking like you, and then and then there was some point of departure where they certainly were their own people and they weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, there are characters in the book that have no immediate relation to me or anyone I know. And I will say those characters were probably easier for me to dash off. They just felt, because they were wholly invented, I felt like I found their voices easier. And I did have to ask myself, like, is this mine? Is this Alex? Who is this? I mean, where is this coming from? And does it sort of feel genuine and rooted?
Yeah.
So that may be true, that it's probably easier. And the thing I'm working on now, I'm working on another book, and these characters are well beyond anything I know. And it is coming a little quicker. I don't know. I think every project is different. Every writer is different. And at different points in your life, you probably feel closer and more directly connected to your own experience than something you can imagine.
Yeah, yeah. But the problem I feel like writing about something that's so closely autobiographical is that then you have to explain, well, I did that because these, 20 reasons in my childhood, whereas if you just invent a character out of whole cloth, you don't have all that sludge dragging you down to try and explain the character's actions, where you're trying to explain your own actions to people. I don't know if that makes sense or not. I was just trying to...
Yeah, I mean, I certainly feel like the only way that I was able to do this was by drawing really on stuff that I felt very deeply, and have seen other people close to me feel deeply.
Yeah.
So I needed to connect with stuff that I actually had tangible emotional experience with.
Yep.
The other thing that I really did learn in writing this is, I had been a journalist and have, continued to do a little bit of that. And when I started to outline the book, I kind of laid out all these incidents. Like I said, I want this to happen, I want this to happen, I want this to happen. I sort of outlined it within an inch of its life. And within about 6 months, I really realized, oh, wow, the fiction that I really love, it really doesn't matter what happens. What matters is how people feel.
Right.
And that became a real revelation for me. As soon as I sort of locked into the emotional components of how these characters were going, that drove the action. That drove what happened. It didn't matter what happened as much as how people were feeling.
And do you think that is different than writing for television? Because writing for television feels very heavily outlined, where you have plot points and certain things have to happen at certain times. And of course you care about how the characters feel, but it feels much more plot heavy than character heavy. And I was wondering if that's the reverse for you for fiction.
Yeah, I mean, I've just finished writing an adaptation of the book for television, and certainly that was my first experience writing TV. I'm surrounded by TV writers, my wife, my best friends, my sister, and I've sort of grown up watching how that happens. And it's definitely way more plot-centric, and that's mainly because, that's what you got on TV, and it's all dialogue, right?
Yeah.
So you're just, all that you're able to do as a writer is really, like, is give people things to say. So yeah, it's much more external.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Christopher Knox, and the book is Plus One. And you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Do you think this is sort of the what the feminist movement went through for women in the 60s and 70s, where they were trying to find their way into the workplace. Do you think men are going through kind of the reverse of that now, where they're trying to find their way into the home?
Yeah, I'm glad that you picked that up, because I've sort of pondered that a lot, which is, you know, my mom is a sort of first wave feminist and divorced my dad and another guy, and then married a woman when I was fairly young, or came out when I was fairly young, married her probably 5 or 6 years ago. But so I sort of saw that up close, and sympathetically sort of feel myself as a feminist. And so to have that same sort of set of challenges about kind of coming to grips with your place in the home and outside the home, as a man, feels very, there's a parallel thing going on. I think we, as guys, we're handling it a lot less gracefully. Guys are much less equipped to kind of gracefully handle the support role. And I think that there's a combination of reasons that that's true. I think some of it is just biological, and some of it is just the social conditioning goes back so far about, you know, guys are assumed to be emasculated or challenged by powerful women.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
that's what,
and
yeah.
Now that women are sort of assuming more roles of power, you know, Sheryl Sandberg said something really smart, you know, the Facebook person said, you know, when women are very successful, people come up to the men and ask if they're okay. When men are very successful, people come up to the women and say, congratulations.
Right.
So it's just, it's assumed that men are somehow threatened. And I think, you know, that's not necessarily the case. My wife's success has not, I don't root against her. I'm thrilled when good things happen for her.
Yeah.
Really am. There's no part of me that's resentful or angry about that. But when people ask you and there's this assumption that you're not okay with it, you begin to really get insecure and start to ask yourself. It can be self-fulfilling.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I was going to ask you where you felt like that aggression in peeling out in the car. I mean, I think women have that. I peel out in the carpool lane all the time because that's just the nature of carpool lanes.
Right, because it sucks.
Because it sucks, yeah. Yeah, but I was wondering if, you know, if you feel like it's the biological, you know, I'm just mired with these kids and this is not my nature to do this, and it's a biological thing, or is it because the other moms are looking over at you and saying, oh, that poor dad, you know, he's here instead of his wife?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination. I'm not going to deny that there are biological differences, and I think it's silly to sort of treat men and women exactly the same. I think that's naive.
Yeah.
I think there are things about being a man that make one feel particularly weird about staying home with the kids.
Yeah.
It's just, and I don't say it's not in our nature. And by and large, I love being home with the kids. But there are these outbursts, these sort of strange kind of pangs of insecurity around it.
Yeah. Well, it
and then
also...
and then there's just, you know, like I have friends, guys who are lawyers and consultants and, you know, regular guy jobs whose lives seem so much simpler than mine.
Right. Yeah.
Because, you know,
absolutely.
The division of labor is so much clearer, and I envy that.
Right. Right.
They're not having to do this crazy juggle and all these, you know, questions themselves about their manhood and fighting the ghosts of their fathers. It's all kind of tangled up and the rules go out the window.
Right, right. So let's talk a little bit about the transition from journalism to fiction and what your career in journalism and this great book, Rejuvenile, which so many well-observed observations. But anyway, what you took from the journalism career that fed the fiction, or was it working against the fiction? Because the voice is so very different from, you know, an informative nonfiction style to character development and emotions and how people feel and all of that. So tell me what was easy and what was hard about that.
There were times when I was writing the novel where I felt like I could have been a cobbler for all that I have been prepared to do this job. Do you know what I mean? It's so different to write fiction than to write nonfiction that it's an entirely new proposition. The process is so very different. But, I mean, one thing that the main point about any kind of writing for me and for a lot of people, very, very few people don't experience this, which is, you know, just keeping your butt in the chair for 2 years and ignoring the internet and just the discipline of staying focused to write.
Right.
That is something that I learned as a journalist and that I think kept me going when I was writing the novel. Which is just the discipline of staying focused and staying on task and looking, you know, playing the long game.
Right.
Certainly the kind of topicality of this book was informed by journalism. I knew that I was having an experience that was a sort of exaggerated, amplified version of what a lot of men were going through. And I recognize that. That's sort of what led to the first book, Rejuvenile, which is after I had a couple of kids. I was playing with them in a way that I knew that my father had never played with me. And I looked around and saw lots of changes in maturity that seemed to me resonant. So I was able to write a book about it because I saw it in my own life. And the same thing for this. I saw stuff happening in my own life. I said, oh, okay, this is happening for others. Maybe I can dig into this. And it just felt like this one wanted to be a novel more than it wanted to be nonfiction.
Yeah, yeah. You had a good advice, which is not to write at home where all of the distractions and, you know, can get you down. I like the discipline, going back to your point about discipline and keeping your butt in the chair of sitting in the library somewhere and, you know, not being distracted. Libraries have a good way of doing that. There's nothing else to do.
Yeah, I'm really superstitious about where I write. I try writing at home. I have a really terrific home office that should be, you know, perfect. It looks, you know, I have a window and it just seems like an ideal place to write, and I can't write there at all. And partially it's just because, you know, there's a delivery or the dog is barking or whatever it is, or the phone rings. But some of it is you get juju, right? You get like, I have a good writing day at a particular table in a particular room at a particular library, and I'll return there. And I feel like there's energetically good places. And I will drive 40 minutes to get to a good place. If,
right.
You know, and some of that I think is also just about, like, you have to actually, for me anyway, I have to have a little bit of trouble to get myself into that position in order for it to work.
Yeah.
If it's too easy, like if I'm just rolling out of bed and sitting in my desk, I usually can't get it going. But if I have to, like, commute.
That's the beauty of L.A. is it would take you 40 minutes to get anywhere, really, in L.A. So.
Exactly.
Once you leave your house, it's going to be 40 minutes no matter where you're going. So that's perfect.
It's true. It is definitely true.
So tell me a little bit about writing. Writing dialogue is very difficult. Well, it's very difficult for me. I know it's difficult for a lot of people. Hearing, you know, the inclination to either, you know, be the tape recorder in the room, which is never interesting for anybody, or to have dialogue that's so stilted because you're trying to get some point across. You have a very natural way with it. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about getting characters' voices, authentic ear, knowing when dialogue isn't working, whether you read it out loud, all of your tips and tricks for dialogue.
Well, you've just said a few of them. I mean, obviously reading them out loud is essential because a dialogue, first of all, has to sound like speech, right? So one thing that I learned from my wife, Genji, who writes dialogue, you know, for a living and is really a master at it, is, and I keep this in mind a lot when I'm writing dialogue, which is a piece of dialogue has to belong to the character saying it. So if the test is, if you could take that piece of dialogue and give it to another character, it doesn't work. You can't switch. Anytime the second, oh, that's a good line, I'll give it to that person, that's a cheat. Then you know you're fudging it. A line has to come from that character. This sounds a little woo-woo, but I definitely try to listen to the character and try to get out of the way. right? Yep. You shouldn't be writing the dialogue.
Yep.
Try to just focus on who it is and let them say it. And then there's just a very practical thing, which is, you know, always use, is it contractions? I mean, you make it simple.
Yeah,
In general, don't speak in paragraphs. And when we write dialogue, sometimes we think of full sentences and things. You know, shorthand, people speak in much more clipped ways. And those are just tricks that you can use to make things sound more like speech.
I really like this idea that if you tried to put a line in somebody else's mouth, and if it works, you've done it wrong. And kind of taking all of the attributions, the dialogue attributions off, and making sure that you know who's saying each line, you know, even if you don't have the he said, she said stuff at the end of it.
I had to learn that. And I don't know that I was entirely successful at that, which is getting rid of all the he said, she saids. I have an audio book of this novel that I really love, because it's the first time I was actually able, since writing the book, to kind of appreciate it as something that didn't come from me. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know, you look at a book that you read. I read Rejuvenile, and I can't separate it from what was on my word processor. But there's a really beautiful audio book that this production company up in Portland did, and the guy who reads it does all the voices. And so I was able to hear it really as something separate. And in doing so, I was like, oh, okay, those are totally different people than me.
Yeah,
So, yeah, if you can get somebody else to read your material,
that's a good
idea.
That will also
help a lot.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I'm curious.
Have a friend or loved one read your stuff.
Yeah, right.
You'll see it in a totally new way.
Right. Take them out for a steak dinner and make them read your stuff to you. I like that. My guest this morning is Christopher Noxon. The book is Plus One, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm curious what it's like to live in a household of writers. Obviously, your wife is a fantastic writer. Your sister is, I think, living with you, and a great writer. And I was wondering if there's a synergy, or if it's a draining thing, or if you bounce ideas off of each other. But I've never been in a situation where you have so many writers under one roof. And I was wondering if that's helpful or hurtful sometimes.
It's hard for me to know if it's hurtful, because I haven't had any other experience. My wife and I have been married 17 years. We were writers when we met, and we're writers now. I do think it can be difficult because we're both moody, and I'm pretty needy, and she's crazy busy. And, you know, we're crazy writers who are constantly churning on our own experience and bearing down on deadlines and feeling despair of rejection and the rest of it. So, yeah, it would be easier if one of us was probably like a very even-keeled career person.
Salesman, right?
But, like, look, I love what she does, and I'm a fan, so that's terrific. And I'm able to kind of... And I, you know, read her scripts and watch her cuts, and so that's amazing for me to have that front row seat. And I think she, you know, appreciates what I do as well. So we're there for each other in that way. And I think if I did something else entirely, it would be harder for me to be as on board for her as I am.
Right, right. You had talked about writing the book, not necessarily writing what you know, which you probably did as well, but writing what you wanted to read. And I was wondering if through the writing of this, you came to view your own, like, even though the characters are not you, if through the writing, I don't want this to get all therapeutic, but if through the writing process you learned something, about writing that you'll use the next time, and B, about, you know, the situation that you were writing about that was kind of a discovery point for you through writing it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely believe in the old cliche about write what you want to read. And what I learned coming out of the last book was, I think I kind of wrote the last book as an assignment, and sort of as if I was in school trying to please the professor. And this one, I sort of gave in to my joy. I wanted to create pleasure, right? Mm. I wanted to, when I'm reading a book that I love and I don't want it to end, I had to look at, like, the books that I love and what was it about them that did that. And some of that was just posing questions that get answered later, just basic narrative suspense tricks.
Yeah.
And some of it is voice, and some of it is really intimate, kind of below the surface feeling stuff. You know, how do people really feel? What do they say on the car ride home from the party? That's something I ask myself a lot. Like, what's the real kind of unvarnished truth about this situation?
Mm-hmm.
And can I capture that? That was a sort of challenge for myself. And then, you know, in terms of like my actual life, did I go beyond it or learn anything from it? There's a point in the book in which he sort of comes to grips with his life, the character does, Alex, and he sort of has to say to himself, look, however I ended up with this life, this is the one I have, and I can either fight against it and feel resentful about it, or I can just kind of come to live in it. And that sounds a little almost spiritual, but I, in my, you know, sort of deepest, I think most peaceful moments, I land on that, which is you can analyze and fight against and obsess over the circumstances of your life forever, but at a certain point, you just have to settle into it and come to grips, you know, and just kind of make peace with it. And I think hopefully Alex does that. Hopefully at the end of the book, people feel that he's earned that sense of sort of peace with himself.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that I've gotten there. In good moments, I have a certain peace with my life, but I think it's something we all struggle with, which is how do we kind of make it better and challenge ourselves, but also accept it.
Yeah, it's a life.
Find some kind of acceptance.
Right, right. A life. You know, life would be over if we weren't still learning something new. So it's good.
Right.
It's good. Yeah. Are we, we're drawing down on our time, but I was wondering if we didn't cover some piece of advice or wisdom that you like to share with writers that, is helpful along the way.
I was talking about this with a friend of mine yesterday. Who was thinking about writing something, a big project, and he's not been writing for a long time. You know, I love teachers like Anne Lamott and Natalie Goldberg and Stephen King and people who've written about sort of the process. I turn to those books when I get sort of despairing. And one thing that they all sort of land on, and that is pretty obvious, but I have to remind myself of it all the time, is, you know, writing is practice, right?
Yeah.
You just got to do it all the time. You have to. The best stuff comes out of just a kind of regular routine, and at least for me, I have to sort of give myself some discipline. I treat myself like a toddler. Like I set a timer and say, for 50 minutes, I'm going to write new words. I'm not going to go back and edit. I'm not going to check my email. I'm not going to go down a Google wormhole and try to discover some little factual piece of information. I have to write new words for 50 minutes. I'm setting the timer. I'm turning on this little thing called Freedom on my computer that shuts off my internet, and I'm going to do this. And I do, you know, 50-minute sprints in order to get through it. And I find that without that kind of discipline and without that kind of taskmaster approach to myself, I'm never going to get anything done.
Right? Isn't that true? I like that. Freedom is the program that'll turn off your internet. That is good advice right there.
And it's a free piece of software, and I love that it's called Freedom.
Freedom is great, yes.
Freedom, and it shuts off your internet for a certain number of minutes, and it frees you up.
Brilliant, brilliant. Where do we find you online when we want to find out more? And are you talking around in Southern California at all, or how can we find you?
Yeah, I have a couple of things coming up. I'm going to be in Orange County at Literary Orange. I'm not sure what the date of that is, but
yep.
I think it's in about a month.
Early April. Yeah. I think.
I am doing a reading at Skylight Bookstore in Los Angeles this next Thursday, February 5th.
Excellent.
And I am online at www.christophernoxon.com.
I love it. Are you on Facebook, and do you do all that stuff, social media stuff?
I'm on Facebook. I have an author page on Facebook.
Great.
I'm on Twitter. It's C. Noxon.
All those
emotional
places.
Outlets.
Wonderful. Christopher Noxon, this is a huge pleasure. Oh, go ahead.
That's all right. That's it.
Yep. This was great. This was great. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That was Christopher Noxon. The book is Plus One. It is out and available now. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Tara Eisen will be on for the second half. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. We are on iTunes under College Radio. We are on Barbara's website, penonfire.com. We are on Stitcher. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. There is no excuse not to find us. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Tara Eisen is on with me now. She is the author of the novels The List, which she was on with me on several years ago, A Child Out of Alcatraz, a finalist for the LA Times Book Prize, and Rockaway, featured as one of the best books of summer in Oprah magazine. She has a short story collection coming up, Ball, from Counterpoint Soft Skull Press. She's had short fiction essays and book reviews in so many places, I'm not even going to tell you all of them. She was the co-writer, you might know, of the cult movie Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead back in the, I think, early 90s. She has her MFA from fiction and literature at Bennington. She is now in Arizona, teaching at Arizona State University. It is her essay collection, Reeling Through Life, How I Learned to Live, Love... I don't have the book title right in front of me. How I Learned to Live, Love, and Die at the Movies, I believe it is.
How I Learned to Live, Love, and Die at the Movies.
Thank you. I read it on my Kindle. I don't normally do that, but I read it on my Kindle. How are you? Welcome back.
I'm good. It's lovely to talk with you again. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back on. So tell us a little. I'm going to let you talk about the memoir slash film class. So good. Collection of essays. Talk a little bit about Reeling Through Life and sort of how it came to life.
Okay. A while back, someone had asked me when I knew I wanted to be a writer or how I decided to be a writer. And for years, I've given, my usual answer has been that I loved books so much as a child, and I loved writing and words and language and story. And in a way, all of that's true, but when this was asked to me more recently, I sort of realized that I'm a writer, it has less to do with writing. And the reason I'm a writer actually has a lot more to do with movies. And it's because I saw the film Julia when I was 13 years old, about Lillian Hellman, played by Jane Fonda. And it was the first movie I'd ever seen about a writer. It was the first depiction of a writer I'd ever seen. And it just looked so glamorous. She wears these great clothes, and she has the beach house. And Jason Robards plays Dashiell Hammett, her lover, and out on the beach digging them clams for dinner. And when she can't write, she goes to Paris to, live in a little Parisian garret and drink wine and sandwiches. And she's plunking away at the old manual typewriter. And it just looked, I just thought, that's what I want. That's the life that I want. And so I wanted to be a writer before I actually wanted to write. And it was because of the life of writers in movies. And I wrote an essay about that. And as I was working on the essay, I realized there were so many other aspects of my identity that have been shaped and influenced by film. And maybe I could keep looking at this and exploring this. And it became a book. And so there are 9 essays, and each essay, again, sort of looks, it's part film criticism, part memoir, and each essay looks at a collection of films that are about a certain idea interwoven with my own life experience. So in addition to How to Be a Writer, we have How to Go Crazy, How to Be a Jew, How to Be a Slut, how to be Lolita, how to be a drunk, how to be Mrs. Robinson, how to die with style. And I really was trying to hit sort of the universal themes of love, sex, faith, career, family, in the way that I think so many of us are influenced by film.
So good. She did a much nicer portrayal than Jack Nicholson did in The Shining. I did not want to be a writer.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's one of the films I referenced in How to Be a Writer. There's also all of the glamour ideas of movies. Like another one would be Red, where, you know, Diane Keaton has both Jack Nicholson and Warren Beatty in love with her. And again, there's the beach house. For some reason, writers always have beach houses.
Right.
Then there's sort of the nexus between writers and going crazy. And I think Jack Nicholson in The Shining is a really
does
good
that
example
too. Yeah.
of how, you know, not the kind of writer experience I want to be or have.
Jed, nobody goes crazy better than Jack Nicholson. He can go crazy in every movie he's in.
Absolutely. And he is one of the scariest. And you always know that even when he's not playing a crazy person, you know that it's simmering, that
yes.
he's got that
yes.
sort of potential to be unhinged at
right.
any second.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you never turn your back on Jack. That's my motto. So this
yeah.
does such a nice, this is so nicely balanced between this weaving of memoir and film and observations that you had through the films. And the thing that strikes me as tricky to do about this is there are a lot of movies in here. I mean, there's probably like 100,
yeah.
right? And
yeah,
so
yeah.
your average reader has probably seen, I don't know, half of them maybe. I've probably seen half of them. So you have to give enough information about the movie for people who haven't seen it, but you also can't give so much that the people who have seen it are just
yeah.
going to stop reading. So tell me a little bit
yeah.
about finding that very delicate balance, because I thought you did a really nice job with that.
Oh, thank you so much. I think it's an impossible balance. I you know, because you're right that the people who maybe have seen the film I'm talking about, my summary of the film might seem like, yeah, I know, I've seen the film. But then for someone who hasn't seen the film, I had to give enough information that they would be able to follow what I was talking about, that they would then still find it interesting and engaging. And it was that sort of constant threading the needle kind of thing.
Yeah.
I kept trying to come back to the focus on what was most relevant to the life experience I was also trying to illuminate. There were movies where, there are some movies where I really only discuss them for a sentence or two, because there really is just the one image that stuck with me and got under my skin and was so incredibly memorable. Or there was the one line of dialogue that I took away from me and I've never stopped hearing in my head. And so for those, there was no reason for me to give an elaborate synopsis or a comprehensive plot summary, because I really was just teasing out that one element of the film. But then there were other films where it is the arc of the storyline
yes,
that
right.
was so resonant for me, that it was, you know, following the journey of the character from the beginning of the story to the end. And that required me to give a little bit more synopsis.
Right.
of the film. But I was constantly questioning the balance of that. I think sometimes I over-summarize, maybe sometimes I under-summarize, but I wanted to stay just as well as on point as I could.
Right.
Or what about the film touched me so much and in ideally touched other people
right.
in a similar way.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about these essays to me, so we're 7 years apart in age, so as I was reading your Little Darlings section on losing your virginity, I was 7 years behind you, but that movie also had a profound impact on me as well, and I was wondering if you were aware at the time that the movie was sort of your surrogate mother or your surrogate big sister, or, you know, if your actions at the time were influenced by what you were learning through these movies, or if it was in hindsight in writing the essays where you said, you know, now I can see how that movie was at play in my thinking at the time, but I wasn't really so aware of it then.
Yeah. I think both happened. I mean, first of all, I'm so glad that you've seen Little Darlings and found it memorable, because it's a movie that I feel has sort of gotten lost. And it's a movie that I absolutely feel should be required viewing for all 11 and 12-year-old girls.
Yeah.
it was so important to me. And I always want to make the point that it's not an anti-sex movie. I didn't find it prudish at all. It just was such a sensitive and comprehensive look at sexuality for an adolescent girl, for a girl right at that sort of 14, 15-year-old point,
yeah.
You know, where are you a woman? Are you a girl? You're craving a kind of intimacy. Your body is becoming sexually aware, but are you emotionally prepared for what the experience has the potential to be, both positively and negatively?
Right.
And I thought that movie just did it unlike any other movie I've seen.
Right.
I think, you know, some of the movies I discussed back from being age, six, seven, eight, you know, through my teens into young adulthood, some of the films I discussed I've seen more, you know, far more recently in my 30s and 40s. So the older I am when I saw the film for the first time, I think the more cognizant I am of the quote, the lesson that I'm learning, and I'm able to sift through what I've learned or experienced in reality and what the movie is offering me as an example, as a life lesson. I think the earlier I go back, the less cognizant I am of that in a way, but the younger I am, the purer the experience. It's almost more like the direct pipeline.
Yes,
to my heart and soul,
right?
Because I remember some of these experiences so viscerally. I had no filter, you know, no social awareness, no experience of the world, and so an image like Jack Nicholson, back to Jack Nicholson, getting electroshock therapy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I was 11 years old. I didn't know any such thing as electroshock therapy existed. I knew nothing about it. And I remember, even just talking about it, even while I was writing the essay, I remember this terror in my stomach as they were strapping him down. I didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah.
But my heart was racing, and that scene just seared itself into my consciousness in an absolutely visceral way. Another example would be when I was much even younger. I think I was 6 years old. And I saw The Prime of Miss June Brody.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And there's a scene where one of the characters who we've known as a schoolgirl, 13, 14, 15 years old, is now 17 years old in the film and is stark naked posing for her lover, who's a, you know, 40-year-old artist. And that shot of her nudity was so shocking to me. Because it wasn't just a naked little girl running around the pool. It was a 17-year-old girl deliberately choosing to put herself on sort of sexual display.
Right.
And it was that transition from little girl nudity to adult sexualized female nudity, I've never forgotten it. It imprinted itself on me.
And it's amazing reliving the movies in my head and reliving your and then reading about your experiences living through the movies in your head is all very specific. But the themes of all of these essays are so very universal. I'm not Jewish, but I could relate to everything. But I could relate to that one. And I could relate to certainly the drinking, the essay on drinking. I mean, there's so much in here to mine. But I think that ability to take something very specific. And now we have a universal memory that we all have of seeing that scene in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and all of our experiences. But then taking that to your specific experience makes it somehow very universal, I think, in the reader's mind, that we're all right back there again with our own feelings about that scene.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, that's you know, what I was going for. I mean, I think as a writer, we're taught You know, we recognize ourselves in the specific, in a way, not in the universal.
Right.
That, you know, don't go generic, go specific, go idiosyncratic, go specific, because it's our connection to the specific details in our lives and the specific choices and experiences that we have. That's what other people relate to.
Right, exactly.
And so, that is what I was going for, was to have these universal themes, love, sex, death, faith, career, family, but using my specific relationship to specific moments from film to illustrate that.
Exactly, exactly. My guest this morning is Tara Eisen. The book is Reeling Through Life. It's a book of essays on movies, film, and part memoir. So let's talk a bit about what makes an effective essay and I mean, these are unique because it is part memoir, part film criticism. But tell me what you learned. First of all, I know selling a book of essays is not that easy. So you can maybe you can also put a little plug in there for, you know, how you market a book of essays. But what makes an essay effective? We talked about it, trying to be very specific, but how much narrative, how much storytelling versus, sort of the nonfiction article thing I assume you want to get away from. Talk a little bit about what makes a good essay.
Yeah. I think for me, one of the reasons I'm attracted to the form is, you know, the essay is exploration. The essay not as an assertion of a theory or a philosophy, but as to me, the most interesting part of essays are the questions they raise, not necessarily the answers they provide. And to have the opportunity to look at something from a 360-degree perspective and test your own questions. I say, if I'm looking at something like The Crime of Miss Jean Brody and Little Girl Sexuality as an example, it's the question of, I'll talk about Taxi Driver and the depiction of Jodie Foster as the 12-year-old prostitute. I was horrified by it, and at the same time, I was allured to her as a character. Mm. And part of the essay, I have to look at my own fascination with her sexuality, not just my distaste for, you know, the obscenity of these. The pimp forcing her into the role of being a child prostitute.
Right.
So sort of really having to ask the questions from multiple perspectives. I'm attracted to that in essays when I read essays, and that was also something I was looking to do in these essays, test my theory, test what I thought I knew about myself, test what I thought I knew and understood about these films. And then I think the other thing that attracts me to essays, and you use the word narrative, and I think that's perfect because you're still telling a story. And I think the selection of the quote material that you use in an essay is so critical. You still need, at least in a personal essay, which is what these are rather than critical essays, you still need the character. You still need to determine moments of incident that can create narrative momentum and interest and drama, basically.
Yes, right.
You know, you can't just sort of, especially in memoir, you know, you can't just summarize your whole life. So the selection of the moments to look at, not just across the chronological span of your life, I think, if you're writing memoir, but also how you structure the moments that you've selected. It, you know, going chronologically is not always the way to go.
Right.
And I think that I find that challenging and really interesting, that here's the truth. I am trying to write about, quote, the truth. I'm trying to write about real events. And yet as a writer, I still have an obligation to structure the story in a way that will be the most engaging for a reader.
Right, right. The hard part of this seems like you have so many movies that are related to so many parts of your life, and then continuing to make that connection between here's a plot point in a movie and here's a plot point in my life and here's a plot point in a movie, and not have that feel redundant or forced or, you know, a device is really good. I mean, there's a great example in the drinking essay where you saw a PSA after school special on why it's, you know, why it's bad to be a teenage alcoholic, and then you set out to try and become a teenage alcoholic.
I Sarah T, Portrait of a Teenage Alcoholic, one of those Linda Blair TV movies. And in the book, I generally stick with theatrical films, but there were a couple of television movies that were just, you know, so critical. I got it into my head. They don't make movies about normal girls. They make movies about characters and people who are special enough to be interesting enough to have a movie show the story of their life. I mean, it was sort of a twisted thinking. But after I saw Sarah T. Portrait of a Teenage Alcoholic, I was one of those good girls. You know, I was well-behaved. I was a good girl. And it's sort of easy to get overlooked when you're so well-behaved.
Yes.
You know, because you're, you know, of course, there's no problem.
Right.
And when you feel upset about something, when you're struggling with something, you sort of learn not to show that, because you're supposed to be the well-behaved, good little girl. And after watching this movie about a teenage alcoholic, I went to the liquor cabinet and I poured myself a big glass of scotch or wine or whatever was open. And I did that every night for 2 weeks because I thought it would make me special.
Interesting, yeah.
It would make strange moral to that story, I guess. But
No, it's wonderful. I mean, you know, to see the direct application of I saw this on TV and I'm going to replicate it in my life, as opposed to some of the other essays where, you know, you could reflect back on, you know, some experience and then refer it back to a movie that you'd seen and try and make sense of it through the narrative of a film, I think is they're both interesting ways. Sadly, we've drawn down on our time, but and we could go on forever, but are there pieces of advice for either that you've garnered through? I mean, you've done short stories and essays and novels, and is there advice that comes out of this project, something you learned writing-wise out of this project that you would pass along?
I think I was really lucky with this project because I had the movies to rely on. I love research. I try to incorporate a lot of research into everything I write because it's a great excuse not to write and still feel that you're being productive.
Yes.
And so it was wonderful when I didn't really want to sit there in the chair writing, which I never want to do anyway, I could think, oh, well, I really need to watch this movie again. I really need to watch One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest again. I really need to watch The Graduate again. And I could leave my desk, I could sit there with the movie, studying it, taking notes, and still feel engaged with the project and with the process of writing. But it got me out of my own head. It sort of was able to externalize the process a little bit. So I don't know if that's advice. I would say that that's one of the reasons it was one of the ways I got through this project.
Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah.
It's like, it's not about myself and, oh my God, am I writing the most perfect sentence anyone's ever written? It's, well, I need to now study this other thing and try to learn from it.
Right.
And that was really useful. So I think, right, you know, whether it's a short story or a novel or nonfiction, I love research. I love incorporating things that aren't about me, that force me out of my own head, that I can learn from and then try to bring back to the writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, is a wonderful way to get through the process.
Wonderful. Tara Eisen, thank you so much for coming back on. This was
Marie, thank you so much for having me. It's been great. I appreciate it.
That was Tara Eisen. The book Reeling Through Life is out and available now. You can find Tara. She's on Facebook. She has a website, taraeisen.com. You can find her there. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned. Sister Rue is coming up next on Roots and Rhythms with a little bit of reggae. And I encourage you to check out our programming guide for a lot of great talk, a lot of great music, a lot of great everything on KUCI. We've got a plethora of a great show. Speaking of film, we have a great show on Friday after Friday afternoons called Film, or Friday mornings, I'm sorry, called Film School. Mike Caspar takes you through all of the independent films, interviews a bunch of fantastic directors. We have legal shows, we have food shows, we have Ask a Leader shows. So check out our programming guide on KUCI.org for information on all of that. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. as always. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day. I can be something.